reasonable. To the others, she said, I hate it when he's more reasonable than the rest of you. We have to talk. There were only two other seats. Chia took the one beside Akia's, as if it was her right, and the traveler took the last remaining because the bandit refused to. Not the bandit, he corrected himself. Koru, the others called her. No matter what she had been, a warrior, a thief, a demon, he'd had no small part in shaping the woman she had become. Moreover, he had killed her and not enjoyed it. At the end of all things, he owed her the dignity of a name. Koru scowled at him from her place by the door, as if she could hear his thoughts. Her glare told him to stuff his opinions away somewhere she'd not have to suspect they existed. What's happened? Asked the traveler. They spoke lightly as ever, but the black pool that was their presence in the forest rippled uncontrollably, even when their cat slunk up from the floor to settle in their lap. What could anyone expect? They had just killed their master. They glanced at him for a moment, and there was an urge in the Ronin's chest to speak. He didn't know what words to offer, and in any case, he'd been asked to keep them to himself. He returned to the puzzle box. That's the problem, isn't it? Akia waved out the window. Everything's happened. Are we even on the same page anymore? I feel like we aren't. Koru's look was oddly troubled for someone who had never been their ally. The Ronin admittedly struggled to understand her presence in the Crow, outside of the fact that she likely also didn't wish to be caught by the Jedi. Conversely, Chia tilted her head, intrigued. My intentions haven't changed, said the traveler. Have yours, Akia? Asked Chia. Akia raised her chin. You first. Chia unhurriedly sipped tea from a thermos. I don't know that I'd say anything's changed. More that my opinions have been made more clear. But if you're suggesting I have an opportunity to sway yours... Chia, really? The traveler asked. I thought we discussed this. I think you'll find I thought the discussion tabled while we were prioritizing survival. But if we're questioning our commitment to running to Reizu... Why ever would we do that? She looked at them with the sympathetic air of an auntie addressing an underemployed young person. It puts you in the position of relying on those who you might not otherwise wish to. That sounds nearly accusatory. Oh, it is. I wouldn't go so far as to blame you for the initiation of open aggression, but I wouldn't say your choice in allies helped us avoid it. Her implication was clear. The traveler might not have rent apart the Reverend, but it would have been in fewer pieces if they'd left the Ronin to his misbegotten devices in a far corner of the galaxy. Don't be a fool, Koru snapped. She waved her hand at the glittering carcass floating outside the viewport. Your lords wanted war either way. This is an excuse, not a cause. I wouldn't delineate so cleanly, said Chia. You blame easily enough. Well, I'd like us to take some responsibility. Take responsibility? Akia snorted. Is that what you thought you were doing when you threw in with the Jedi? You know what we're dealing with. You've seen the demons. And still, you helped them track us down. Chia met her glare with unflappable equanimity. Are you so sure I chose wrongly? Yes, said Akia, but she descended into an icy silence that complicated her claim. She questioned herself, and likely more than that. It would be hard not to doubt, with the consequence of her allegiances scattered in the space between her and Dekian. The traveler let out a sound that might have been a laugh in brighter contexts. If you had doubts, Chia, I wish you'd told them to me. I didn't doubt you. Chia raised a hand at their chiding frown. Akia's right. I've seen what I've seen, more than any of you have, I expect. Hanrai showed me his reports, Jedi dead and missing. Your Sith witch is hard at work, reaping her puppets. And to what end? Yet you prioritize politics? The traveler could no longer keep the strain from their voice. Chia, what do you imagine happens to the galaxy once Jedi start killing one another in earnest? When the witch has her pick of their ghosts? Chia reached over to touch the traveler's knee more gently than they seemed to expect. For his part, the Ronin tensed in his seat, yet unwilling to trust her intent. But Chie spoke gently as well. I understand your fear, Izuna. I feel it too. But in all my life, I've never heard of a war stopped by a single action, no matter how large.
No, said the Ronin.
Every eye turned to him, and he returned to the puzzle box. It was a brazen thing to remind them of what he had done to stop the last war. It was, from a certain point of view, ironic that he had started the next in much the same way. I suppose we shouldn't be surprised if the Dark Lord still thinks in such simplistic terms, said Chie. Don't flatter him with a title, Koru snapped. He's no lord of mine. He's what? Said Akia. She sounded oddly flat. The Ronin would have expected more anger. Perhaps she couldn't summon any more of that, given the depth of loathing she already harbored for him. Her searching eye had shifted to the traveler.
Did you know?
Their wince gave the lie to their words.
I don't know that I'd claim I was sure. I suspected. There were indications, suggestions.
They broke off because it seemed Akia was about to shout at them. Instead, she sank back into her seat, hand to her brow. The Ronin found himself frowning as well. It had occurred to him that the traveler might know him for who he had been. They knew so many stories for one, and they were Hanrai's pupil for another. But something of their expression now, the disquiet of it, aroused an unnameable suspicion within him. Izuna, said Chie. Did she see how they flinched whenever she said that name? A twitch in their hand was echoed in the flicker of white flare hidden beneath their current.
I won't ask you to abandon those you pity. This man, this woman, we'll tend them as we must, not least to ensure they don't hurt anyone else. But you must see you're chasing a fantasy. The princess won't lay down arms in exchange for a dead Sith's head, no matter how she frightened them. Our work is here.
It isn't, the traveler insisted. This isn't princes and lords, Chie. It's more. It's worse.
Koru scoffed. Nothing's worse than princes.
Jedi, suggested the Ronin.
Sith, said Chie.
Stop it, Akia barked. None of you helped.
The traveler winced.
Akia, no, shut up. You're the worst one.
Akia stood, hands pressed down hard in the console, refusing to look at them.
Damn it, this is why we had to talk. You've had us hunting the witch ever since we met. Not that you ever said a word about how you knew she was around to be hunted. I figured, whatever, you're a Jedi or something. Have to be. But you don't want to talk about it because you don't like Jedi any more than we do. Fine.
Akia's hands curled into fists.
But you never said anything about the Jedi Lord breathing down your neck. Never warned us. Not a word. No wonder Chie threw in with him the second he offered her a gram of truth. Not that I'm letting you off the hook, Auntie. I'm just saying that I get it.
Finally she turned, only to gesture at the Ronin.
And after you picked up the murder-happy Dark Lord himself, offense intended, Grim.
Offense warranted, he agreed.
She made a face, then remembered she now despised him and looked quite sick of him and of herself. She looked away.
Fox, listen to me. I put everything on the line for this. For you. But how am I supposed to trust you? How am I supposed to think you're right? I confess I hoped the air of mysticism would allay some of these concerns, said the traveler.
No,
said the Ronin, and as he did, he opened the box. The crew was for a second time silent as they stared at the bounty he unveiled. The box fit within his palm, but it brimmed with crystals. They shone with refracting light that swam in many colors across their faces in the glass. The reds he had long been collecting, accompanied by blues and greens he didn't recognize, and a colorless multitude that had once been lodged in the artifacts Akia ferried in the Crow. The Ronin selected a clear crystal from the lot and turned it between his fingers before replacing it and choosing another. The others watched him in a state caught between wonder and terror.
he placed the second crystal back into the box as well.
You never said what happened to the shard you found on Dekian, he said, and he looked the traveler in the eye.
They shifted warily under his gaze, as if they expected a skewering thrust.
In any case, it isn't here. We're unlikely to solve your problem unless you give us a little more truth.
They drew back in their seat. If they meant to run, the Ronin couldn't stop them. He was too weak, and no matter how the crew mistrusted the traveler, they would never choose helping him over protecting them. So he did all he could. He begged.
Please. I need an answer, too.
The traveler's mouth opened, closed. When they smiled, he feared he had lost. But at last they spoke, and their confession chilled.
Well, the trouble is, I don't recall. What do I remember? You know, the important things. My favorite tea, how to pray, arithmetic, sort of. Everything else, well, it comes and goes. The Kyber shard, that stayed with me. A sliver, winter sky. Clear, but for where it was split down the middle by a hairline fracture that clouded its center. Lovely little thing. Entrusted to me so that it would guide the way to some dire Sith threat. That's where it gets a bit, how shall I put it, imprecise. I remember the shard, I remember the need, and I remember Reizu. I did try to kill her, the witch. I know I did. I feel it in my fingers and my chest. Because I failed, faltered. I can't tell you why now. I had killed before, even when it hurt to. To wit, I didn't. So what next for the lacking Jedi? I don't know. But I didn't leave. For years, I think. Can you imagine? I wonder if I knew the way out. I wonder if I ignored it. The things that stick, you see, they're sweet in part. Firelight, a scene out a window of a courtyard hung in winter chill, a kind of desolation in the silence. Yet it broke now and again, and I was glad for the sound. Laughter, I think, or a song, some speck of hope buried under frost. The rest, though? Fear. My own, I think? Perhaps in part? An anger, pained and grieving. Loss and sorrow coalescing, calcifying. It hurt to be near. Still, I didn't leave. It makes me think I couldn't. How did I, then? Oh, who knows? I'd like to think it was something I did, that I found the key, or decided it was time, or that perhaps I asked to. But I don't expect that's the case. I remember a fight, drawing blood and bleeding, and I remember the world breaking until it changed. And then I was free. Maybe. I believe she thought me dead. I can't imagine why else she would release me. I was back in the world, but no longer of it. By which I mean, I no longer fit into the hole I'd left behind. I feared returning to that life because I had failed, and because... No. There's nothing else I can say that I'm sure is the truth. And if it's truth you want from me, we'll have to end it here.
Chapter 32.
But can you really take me seriously? Asked Fox as they stroked their cat's twitching ear. Who can say why I know what I do, and why I've forgotten what I don't? Perhaps I'm riddled with holes rent by the black current, or perhaps I'm merely traumatized. Either way, hardly the reliable sort. They sounded sickeningly calm.
Koru searched them for some sign of distress, even discomfort. Nothing. She couldn't tear her eyes away, even if she dearly wished to be looking at anything else. For all she loathed their willingness to poke holes in others' minds, they had been cored in the same way. They were architect and edifice of the same rotten art. It made them eerie and pitiful. Again she heard the echo of the witch, "Let go, let go." What had the witch made Fox relinquish as she scraped them clean? Koru needed to know. She thought, likely foolishly, that knowing would enable her to protect herself. She could more ably protect that which she knew had to be defended. Doubt tugged at her chest as she crossed her arms in front of it. How could she be sure she hadn't already lost whatever it was the witch wished to take? The voice had been so terribly silent of late. "But why didn't you say anything?" Akia demanded. She was all sympathy now, her fury diluted by another's suffering. Fox looked contemplatively upward. "Shame? Paranoia? Some other offshoot of a mind derailed?" "None of the above. I don't know. I think it never occurred." They laughed. "That's a little horrifying, isn't it? You should probably throw me in the gunner pit." "We should what in the what?" said Akia. Koru cursed and turned on her heel, secretly thankful for the distraction. At first, Koru intended to kill the Jedi and be done with it. Akia wouldn't hear of it. "You think I want another demon on my ship?" she said. "One of you is bad enough." "He doesn't have to stay on your ship," said Koru. She was misinterpreted. Koru would have as soon stabbed the man and sent him tumbling out the crow's airlock. Instead, the crew went through the assiduous process of dragging the old man into the escape pod, still affixed to the crow's abdomen, so he could rewire its comms and navigation. He would ensure that the Jedi would land safely on Deck Yen, but be unable to communicate until he did, by which point they would need to be out of the system anyway, or they would already have lost. In the meantime, Koru and Akia went to stand watch over the gunner pit as Chia made for the cargo bay. "I expect the children know about him already," Chia said with a sigh. "We'll want to convince them he isn't worth saving." How that negotiation went, Koru couldn't imagine. Jedi spawn were by turns proud and fearful. She could see why either variety might think a true Jedi their savior when in the company of Sith and traitors. But she and Akia weren't far from the cargo bay, and they'd heard less than a peep from it, so either the children had killed Chia quietly, or the old woman had miraculously brought them to order. Or she had promised them an alternative murder. If so, she hadn't yet struck any of the most likely targets, namely Koru, the old man, and Fox. Koru still sensed both the old man's simmering flare on one side of the ship, and Fox's silvery shadow on the other. She found herself eyeing Fox especially, nearly to the point of losing focus on the gunner pit's soldered hatch. They remained in the galley, where they had been left with the puzzle box and the Kyber when everyone else went to be useful. "I thought you said the shard wasn't in here," they had said as the old man dropped the box in their hands.
"Your master said he gave it to you," the old man had replied. "Did he lie?"
There. That had been when Koru saw the first and only crack in their demeanor. The question split Fox's smile for a single breath, as if they had been cut, then forgotten the injury. "He wasn't in the habit," they said, and surrendered. Koru had detected no disruption in them since. Granted, she had limited facility in reading such things. A weakness, if her masters were to be believed, though she had always preferred to judge those she faced by their words and posture over the subtleties of their presence and the Force. Fox gave her little to work with either way, yet she studied them with an obsession she wished herself rid of. If only she could name what it was she saw in them and what she wanted to see. She knew in part that she was haunted by the offer they'd extended and the questions they had asked. At the time, she had thought them a busybody and a sophist, driven by guilt or some other sickness. Now she understood the legitimacy with which they could claim familiarity with her condition. In all that time they'd spent on Reizu, trapped with the witch, they must have seen someone like Koru. Dozens, even. Must have. Akia nudged Koru's side. Pompous little B-556 had arrived to tell them the escape pod was ready. They extracted the Jedi with only a little difficulty. He was still unconscious, but Akia insisted on doing most of the extracting herself. You'd just drop him again, like he needs another head injury.
I was going to break his legs, said Koru.
More accurately, one arm and one leg. If you for some reason wanted a Jedi alive, you did your best to debilitate them physically, or keep them in enough pain to ruin their focus.
You're thinking something awful, said Akia as they hoisted the man down the corridor.
Koru snorted. I'm thinking you worry too much.
About the Jedi Knight who's been stewing in my ship without me knowing about it?
Sure, too much worrying. That's my problem.
It is, or you would have let me solve it already.
Akia glowered. Koru scowled back. You're never satisfied. We're doing it your way. What more do you want? To her surprise, Akia sighed heavily, as if in apology.
I don't know. For Fox to be an actual creep? For Grimm to be more hateful? For Chia to be wrong? For you to not be here? For me to have not been such an idiot with other people's dead? For none of this to have happened the way it did?
Koru gave her a thoughtful look. Those are some very pointless wishes.
You're a real jerk, you know that?
The old man dragged himself up from the floor as they approached the hatch where the escape pod was attached to the crow.
We could have gotten you a stool, Grimm, Akia scolded.
The old man nodded as he left. Koru suspected he wasn't listening, sulking about his frailties or about the half-truths of his supposed ally. Or about the witch he didn't know how to reach and therefore couldn't kill. Koru didn't know. She didn't want to. She wished it gave her more pleasure to see him so miserable. It simply didn't satisfy. Akia lowered the Jedi onto the bench in the pod with a caution Koru didn't share. Hypocrite. It took Koru a moment to realize she'd been addressed.
What are you talking about?
Pointless wishes? Akia tilted her head out the hatch in the direction the old man had gone.
I see the way you grimace at him. You don't even know if you want him dead. You're just mad.
The accusation struck Koru in the sternum. It made real a thought she had until then known only as the sensation of dragging weight. Her lips peeled back. She meant to spit, "Of course I want him dead. But so does the witch, and I'll deny her all that I can." But other words vied for space in her mouth. Have you seen him? Pathetic. What's the point of killing a worm? She would have been more pleased to see the old man roll over and simply be dead, for him to be a thing she no longer needed to know of. Koru bit her tongue and turned away. Pointless wishing, was it? If only she could be sure that any of her wishes were her own.
Sorry,
Akia said to her back. This took Koru by surprise as well. Neither could she understand.
For what?
Chia told me. She and the kids wouldn't have made it out without you. So, I don't know. You're clearly not the worst person I've ever met. I can't even say I think Grimm dead is worse than Grimm not dead, galactically speaking. So can I really get on your case for that?
Akia flopped onto the seat beside the unconscious Jedi and pulled the medkit out from under the bench, checking its contents. Most of it had been harvested to treat their own injured. She nevertheless surrendered two precious bacta patches out of her vest into the kit before tucking it away and meeting Koru's apprehensive eye. She rubbed the back of her neck and looked away.
I just mean, I get that's not all you are. I don't want to be one thing either. I'm figuring it out.
Koru could summon no response. She waited for Akia on the other side of the hatch, expecting a rejoinder, or an epiphany, wherein Akia realized she'd spoken nonsense to a dead woman. Neither came. Koru was forced to watch in silence as Akia keyed the launch sequence and sent the pod spiraling into Dekien's orbit. Not all she was? Koru couldn't name what else she might be, other than the frustration and the fury and the forward, forward, forward. She could barely suggest that any of that was hers. What else could she dream of as a demon, one whose existence hung on the whim of a witch whose will she dared to defy again and again? Fox had put the question to her as they flew down the Reverend's throat. Who are you trying to be? Who for? For all the witch had taken from Fox, they knew who and what they wanted to be. Kuoru, though, had even less of an answer now than she'd had then. Akia grimaced at the blinking comlink on her wrist. Shogo's calling. Can't be good. Can I get you to keep an eye out from the gunner pit while I figure out what's about to come make itself our problem? Kuoru agreed without argument, both because the task would give her time to think, and because she far preferred the thought of doing something for Akia than the thought of doing it for anyone else, let alone her own untrustworthy self. The Ronin knew it impolite to eavesdrop, that it was a thing not done among those with whom one shared scant space. Living in such quarters, one learned to hear and not listen, to let a certain portion of the things one knew remain ever unsaid. He made an exception now because he wasn't about to bring up any of what he'd heard to Akia, to say nothing of Koru. Instead, he took their words with him to the galley table where the traveler worked. Their cat lay draped half on their lap, and it opened one yellow eye to watch the Ronin ease forward. The traveler didn't look up, and neither did they pour him a cup of tea. Their own sat untouched, their hands preoccupied by the cat and by the Kyber. You're looming, said the traveler. Are you going to threaten me again?
I wouldn't like to.
That isn't a no. The Ronin creaked to the floor.
Why do you always have to make things difficult?
Would you believe it's chronic? As the Ronin poured himself tea, lukewarm, oversteeped, the traveler continued the pretense of their work. They picked a crystal, dawn blue, turned it over, ran their thumb along its length, and placed it on a patterned square of wrapping cloth before taking the next. One after another, each hue distinct, sun red beside spring green and cloud white, and so on. The construction of a lightsaber was a project of patience, skill, and willingness to allow Kyber to define its own purpose. A crystal could not be made to function outside its impulse, not to its most perfect ability. The blades crafted by the masters of old had been forged to suit not a single Jedi, but a lineage, and to be exquisite unto themselves. Small wonder the Jedi clans called the red of the Sith's stolen crystals a curse. The rebels had taken Jedi Kyber to power their own blades, and in doing so perverted the crystal's purpose to serve their bloody ends. The Ronin couldn't say if this was true. He had built tens of blades, and never thought the Kyber he used defiant or terrified, or particularly much of anything. Not until it fell into Sith hands and became the conduit of their need. This, so far as he had seen, was the moment it reddened, when the Kyber attuned itself to a Sith wielder and chose to serve not lineage, but a person, acutely singular. Blood indeed, but not a curse. The next shard the traveler took up was just such a red, deeply so, near to purple. One of those crystals stolen from a Jedi by the Sith in the years of the rebellion until it had again been taken. The Ronin remembered it by the saber of the man he'd killed for it, a Sith who'd retreated to searing desert sands. The hilt had been a handsome artifact, for all the times it had been repaired and refashioned with horn and dyed leather.
Do you know why I collected them? The Ronin asked.
I wouldn't presume to. The traveler laid the crystal down with a rest. You never said.
I told you I went to Dekian to die. They paused.
You didn't put it like that. The Ronin inclined his head. They wouldn't meet his eye. You lived, though, they said.
Yes. I found direction.
Not purpose?
Nothing so grand.
The acridity of the tea flattened on his tongue.
I only knew myself wrong. I doubted that I'd ever done right.
The traveler's hand closed, their mouth just open. He could almost hear their objection. That he had done some right at some time, say when he had forsaken his lord to protect his guardians, or when he had given a new home to Jedi children taken from their kin to be remade in the Empire's image. They wanted to call his intentions honorable despite the consequences. How had they, Jedi, come by such sympathy for the Sith? How much of their life had the witch taken, and how to interpret their kindness? How much of it was truly theirs? No, that care couldn't have come from the witch. Nor was it some gift she had thought to send him. No matter that he had been her sword and shield for all the years she had in turn been his, nor that they had loved each other as much as either of them were capable. She had never been gentle, not with him. Whatever about the traveler he doubted, he could trust this tender impulse, was their own. That was what made it possible to sit across from them now, even as it made him uneasy. He had known precious little kindness, often because he had eschewed it. It had rarely been afforded to him in his youth, and after that, he had not believed it his due. Even now, he felt a thief as he received it. It would have been easier to be angry with them, as he had been on the Reverend when he realized their deceptions. But what anger he felt now was nothing new, and it remained hot only in the deepest core of his being, where it had burned since his boyhood, and where it would continue to roar until he had rendered the last of himself to ash.
"When the witch took Reizu," said the Ronin, "I suspect that she did it in haste, to stop me from tearing the heart out of what I'd made, no matter what it cost her to do so. I can't say how she did it. I wonder if she knows herself. All I had left was the shard and hate. I hated her for it. Hated that she made me question what I'd chosen." He considered the remaining crystals in the box over which the traveler's hand hovered. "I think the shard could have taken me back at any time, if I'd wished it to."
"But you didn't," said the traveler, hand frozen. Did they mean to protect the crystals from him, or was it the other way around?
"I didn't. That's why I left it on Dekian. I knew it was an opportunity, her invitation, and that if I took it, we would kill each other."
The Ronin thought he wanted to smile wryly, but he couldn't.
"Yet I continued to kill the rest. I couldn't undo what I had done. I decided it would only add to my regrets to let the Sith linger on. So I committed to the hunt."
"Did you think they deserved to be hunted?"
"Perhaps not all. I never asked myself that at the beginning. By the time I did, I suppose I only had space to think it because they had grown more difficult to find. That was when she reached me. When she began to lead me to those she thought might be able to kill me before I killed them." For a time, the traveler didn't move. The understanding creeping through their mind remained invisible until their hand settled over the box. As it did, they studied the Ronin with renewed intensity. They had grasped the implication of his words, that although the witch was isolated in whatever faraway place she had taken Reizu, somehow, she had still spoken to him, the lord she had banished from it. He wondered, had she spoken to them as well? Did she still? She had abandoned him after she lashed Hanrai's ghost to her yoke. But then, she had only ever crept into the Ronin's ear to better lure him into her traps. Now he suspected she saw more use in murmuring to her latest lure.
"That seems rude of her," said the traveler.
"I couldn't begrudge her attempts. I still can't. It never did work, or should I say, it hasn't yet."
"Ah, is that it?" The traveler seemed to want to laugh, and when they looked down at the shards, they smiled. "You think she led you to me for the same purpose? Or that I was nudged toward you? That she thought, If all those Sith fail to do him in, why not send a Jedi?
It occurred. But if you've been trying to kill me, you haven't done it very well.
Perhaps I find you too charming.
They didn't argue with the possibility that they had indeed been sent.
The Ronin marked this, alongside their attempt to conceal their dismay. Or perhaps, he said, she sent you for another reason.
Their brow creased. How ominous.
Must it be?
The Ronin bowed his head in consideration.
Your master, Hanrai.
He corrected himself when they steeled against some poisonous memory.
I remember, the traveler said, that steel sharpening their tone.
They were unwilling to have the man evoked unless they controlled the way in which he was. They waved at the crystal spread before them.
He said I had the shard once, implied that we had it still. I'm sure he believed himself, he always did, but it isn't here.
I believe you, the Ronin said, and the traveler softened a mote.
Before that softness could sour into guilt, he went on,
we have more Kyber than what we got from him.
The Ronin put his hand out on the table, palm up. He had done away with the bandages around his hands in order to work on the escape pod, and the flesh in the center of his palms was freshly pale, softer than it had been since his infancy. The traveler regarded the hand in silence. They didn't ask what he wanted, and didn't need to. In that moment, the two of them shared an understanding, one born of shared purpose. A resonance of desire, carried by the force and black current, and reflected in its white flare. The traveler retrieved their lightsaber from the folds of their robes. Their grip lent the weight of history to the blade. No matter how they disliked wielding the weapon, or how complex the relationship with their inheritance of it, they carried the burden as a gift. They held it out with a solemnity. The Ronin nodded to them. The corners of their mouth twitched down, but they let their hand fall away. The hilt lingered, held aloft over the table on the tide of the black current.
I've no facility with such things, said the traveler. They don't ask you to build your own when you're the heir.
They slowed as they spoke, frowning. The Ronin understood the reason. If they were about to find what they hoped to, then at some point the traveler had opened the hilt. Or someone else had.
The Ronin inclined his head. It was a promise that he would fill the gaps in their skill and memory with his own expertise. They accepted the offer with an upturned hand.
Thus, they began their work in tandem, each guiding the other in turn. They took it apart piece by piece, unwound the dark leather strip and the metal shards of ornamentation, released the wooden pegs that kept the sides of the hilt secured together, twisted, flicked, and parted the durasteel core with care for the blade's age and artistry.
It would have been so much easier to simply break the thing, to burn it, as the Ronin had burned so many others. But it was beautiful, a true relic of the age when Jedi clans first swore themselves to serve none but the will of their lords, who were themselves the will of all people, an age when they served more than empire. Though the Ronin thought the empire deserved far less than all the Jedi had dedicated to it, he thought the blade deserved to be honored for the hopes that had shaped it. In the end, it floated in pieces between them, much like the shattered reverent just outside the Crow. At the heart of the unmade lightsaber hung a crystal, small, colorless, and winter clear, but for a cloud at its middle, defined by the crack that ran down its length. The traveler didn't breathe, neither did the Ronin. He had searched for the shard too feverishly to know what to do when he had found it. So he reached up and took it in hand between his thumb and forefinger, without much thought in his head but for that he had to. As he did, the mirror shard consumed him, just as its greater iteration had those many long years ago.
Chapter 33.
Before all else, the Ronin became aware of her.
A face he hadn't seen since he last left Reizu. She, the witch. She sat on her knees across from him, alone in a vast nothing. Next, in the way that one knew of sun and sky, he became aware that all around them, white flare shone dark and black current burned bright, until each became the other, and in so doing, were obliterated. A maddening collapse of substance and truth, and one that sparked an old fear within him. So, he fixed desperately on the one stillness in sight, the witch's face and bearing. As he did, he discovered that she looked not a day older than the day he had left her. A handsome woman, length and angles, her long hair tied back and wisping from the bun, clad in the unpatterned dark kimono and trousers she preferred. For a moment he thought he might wish to reach out and touch her. In the same instant, he understood in his bones that he would not be allowed to. There was aught else to lay hands on. This world she occupied, that the Ronin intruded upon, did not strike him as a world, per se.
"Oh, it's much more than that," she said.
"You know riddles are beyond me," he said.
"Impatient as ever, I see."
He thought for a moment that she wanted to smile, as she once had when she teased him over their games. It wouldn't come. She raised her chin as she took him in, his age and enfeeblements, weighed him.
"What is it you're after?"
He opened his mouth and words failed him. Why did she ask? She had guided him here. She knew all too well what he wanted. Did she need to hear him say it? He found in the next moment that the world spoke for him. It gained shape before his eyes and beneath his feet, and soon he stood upon the famously wide wooden veranda that jutted out from the main hall of the snow-capped Shinsui Temple complex. Ancient wood, varnished and well-tended, elaborately interconnected to rise from the mountainside. As he stepped forward, he spied in the distance a chasm and the hallowed city beyond. Yojo, the old imperial capital on Reizu. The naked eye showed him orderly leagues interrupted only sparsely by smoke. He realized then that he looked not upon Reizu as it might be now, but Reizu as it once had been. As if he needed to confirm, he turned his gaze upward. In the cloudless white sky, a motley fleet hovered in disarray. He remembered this day. The Sith had taken Reizu as they took everything else, with a ravening fire of devotion. They had taken it because they had to. Their lord and their witch had told them so, and they trusted both to think always first of them. If Reizu had to fall, they knew it was for their sake, so they ensured its surrender. To that end, they had lost many ships and more lives, more in a single battle, than the rest of the rebellion combined.
"We thought it worth it, though, didn't we?" said the witch.
She stood beside the Ronin as she had that day. Her eyes were on the horizon, the city, the mountains, and sky. She saw far more than that, farther and deeper, to the ends of the tethers that bound all worlds together.
"It had to be worth it."
He inhaled of frost, undercut by fear sweat, blood tang, and dissipating incense.
"Yes."
He frowned at her. She looked so like the woman for whom he had conquered Reizu, who had in turn conquered Reizu for him, weaving ghosts to turn on their still-living comrades or to rise up and kill again in her name. But though she had been that witch, she was no longer, just as he was no longer the man she had killed for. That young man, arrogant enough to believe victory on the scale of worlds and stars was a possible thing, as well as one he wanted. The witch's lips curved indecipherably as she studied him. Did she see in him more the man he had been, or the man he was? Which did she prefer? Whose answer did she most desire?
"That depends on which if he wants to come back," she said.
"I don't want to. I have to."
"You've never had to do anything."
The witch's look hardened and she turned away, toward the rest of the complex. As she did, their world in the white-black void of force grew to encompass not only the veranda and its view of Reizu, but the Shinsui temple grounds, now emptied. Their warriors had sent the monks and nuns to shelter in the city below. No being remained on the mountainside but for Lord, Witch, and their own, the outlawed and heretical. That was why the skies would soon darken with more ships, formidably pristine, the imperial blades that halved lives and stars alike. For until this day, in imperial eyes, the Sith had been nothing but mud and filth. Now they had dared to seize the imperial heart and homeworld, that which had to be kept immaculate because it was beloved. Now the Sith were poison, and if the Empire didn't excise them in their entirety, they would be its end, because they were proof an Empire could be anything but itself, that it could sicken, that it could die. But then why would we have tempted that anger if we didn't have to? She asked, though he thought she didn't want his reply. At least not until she glanced over her shoulder at him, and her lips curled like a beckoning finger.
I suppose we liked it, knowing we were the measure by which the Empire found itself wanting, that it saw in us the question it dared not ask. What right have you to own us? What right have you to be?
He ached. That wasn't why we did it. The witch turned to the temple.
No, it wasn't.
She looked toward the last thing they had both wanted, that they had needed, the temple, and what lay within. He wished there were a way to see instead his own face as it had been, so that he might search it for a glint of doubt. The fear that though he and his guardians had fought and fought and fought again, that even as their ranks swelled with more warriors fleeing the clans and others who seethed or flinched or grimaced at the dream of empire, they were dying, and that all too soon the day would come when the last of them guttered out. So, Reizu, he had come for an answer and for faith just as she had. Even to this day he couldn't say whether it had been his idea to take Reizu or hers. They had gone everywhere in sympathetic step, shared every triumph and pain, every hope and fear. Just as now, they walked off the veranda and into the darkened hole together. Their steps echoed in uncanny syncopation with the steps they had taken 20 years before. They breached the depths of Shinsui Temple's main hall and were alone but for each other. They had removed all those who would allow themselves to be shepherded. The inevitable resistance had been seen to as necessary, and the blood smeared on the varnished wooden floors was so stark in his memory, though he thought that at the time he had dismissed it.
What did you feel when you saw it?
She asked. She didn't mean the blood. As he lifted his gaze from the floor to the mirror, he found himself forgetting it too.
Hope, he said, because he couldn't bear a lie.
The Kyber mirror rose from the stained wooden dais that was also its altar. They had heard stories of its creation, that it had been found, or fashioned, or given by gods, or that it was itself one of divinity. These all vanished from his mind as he drank in the sight. So tremendous that it exceeded the mind's ability to hold it in all at once. It was rendered a vertical lake of darkness by the shadows of the hall. The monolithic patterned lanterns that hung from the rafters to make the mirror brilliant had been extinguished. The only light gleamed shallowly from twin candles on slender posts on either side of the dais, and they lit the witch's face as she approached. The story spoke of more than the mirror's origin. It was said it had given dominion to so many others, lords and emperors and Jedi. But he and she, they dreamed first of safety, true peace for their people, who had thus far known only hard-won moments of respite. They dared to wish for an end to all this struggle, and they thought themselves willing to pay for it if only they could be shown what it was they reached for. Her face, reflected in the mirror's consuming well. That was what had made it seem possible to him. "I'd be flattered if I didn't know you better," she said. She meant, if I didn't know what came next. He wanted to turn away, but he couldn't. She knelt before the dais, on boards worn smooth with other supplications, and she began to pray, just as she had those 20 years ago. It was as if her obeisance to their past trapped him within it as well. He stood just behind her watchful guard, and he waited. For hours, she prayed. Then through the night and into the next day, then another. Their fellows came to him, silent in their veneration. They believed wholeheartedly not in the mirror and its secrets, but in those who had led them to it. He ate and drank what they brought, and he fed on their conviction because his own threatened to flag. Still, she did not eat, did not sleep, did not move. She was in a trance, and he had never seen her fall so far. Their people needed him. The Empire loomed. Scout ships and drones were spied at the edge of the system, encroaching ever closer. Rumors came from their own scouts and far-flung allies of a fleet amassing, ready to descend, a newfound alliance of lords. He told their lieutenants to muster again, to be ready to fight for their right to breathe. He wavered on his feet, into dreams where he was compelled to bloody the temple boards once more, to keep her eyes clear until she at last found their truth. But her eyes remained closed, her breathing even. He began to fear she would die this way. "When did you lose patience?" she asked. She never looked away from the mirror. He couldn't rightly say her mouth had moved. "Is that how it works?" he asked through gritted teeth. He wanted to move, to leave, but she forced him still. "A stark and obvious moment when one breaks."
"It was for you."
"Not here. I was only afraid here. Afraid of the Empire. Afraid for you. Afraid of what you had seen. Or that you wouldn't see anything."
"You didn't trust me."
"I did," he insists. "I knew you wanted an answer too, as much as I did, or more." He trembled. His body still wanted to move. He now feared that it would. "But want isn't ever enough." He took the first step forward. His muscles and joints were sore from the standing, ever standing, but he left his post behind her and walked toward the dais, up the stairs and to the mirror, as offhandedly as he would have approached any familiar artifact of his daily life. In the same idle way, he placed his hand flat upon the Khyber.
He was engulfed. So thoroughly did the mirror consume him that for a time he ceased to be. He wanted an end, an answer. He received...
"What did you see?"
she asked. He could no longer see her. He could no longer see himself. He struggled to answer, to have voice, clinging to words as to buoyant wood in a thundering torrent.
"Didn't you see it too? Isn't that why you sat there, silent, keeping it from me? Because you needed another answer. Something better than the truth." Because she had thought the truth would destroy him.
It came to him again as it had then. The entirety of what they had both beheld. Rise and fall. Conflict unending. Every struggle marked by the birth of the next within itself, no end, only consequence upon consequence, violence upon violence. Eons of it, worlds of it, the pain and the want. Their people had won freedom at the cost of others, and they protected their own with killing. This they knew, And it had been so worth it when they had been only themselves unto themselves. Two once Jedi, now Sith, who dared to believe that they could resist the tide that sought their drowning by keeping each other afloat. But in the mirror, oneself disintegrated, and in its place, there was Vision. He had carried suddenly the burden of every loss, pain, and sin he had accumulated by the decisions of he in himself. Kith and kin rent from hearth and home, and what had been home now a sundered shadow, only a bitter memory to every wailing, weeping soul. He sought to think, I want none of this. I want it done. I want the silence of sweet night and warm arms and the right to die only because my bones can no longer hold me. I want it for them, too, because I have sworn myself to them and forsworn all else because of it. I want, she murmured. Yes, I think that's where we went wrong. We wanted too much, and all of it wrongly. He broke away, as if from choking depths to frigid air, one cold cutting another. The witch had seized him around the arms to drag him back from the mirror, and she yanked because he resisted. The mirror reveals, the story said. It is clarity unyielding. By its light, you may see the path to uncompromising victory. What it had shown him was not success. It was death, suffering, and woe. He would not tolerate it. He couldn't. He ripped free of her grasp and lunged toward the mirror. He struck it, bare-fisted, incandescent with fury and flare, surging with ruthless current. The fracture shrieked up from the point of impact, then lanced down. It wasn't enough. He wished with frantic horror for every image, every pain that the mirror had poured into him to disappear back into the channel from which it had come. With his wish, the fracture widened, gasped, fanned. A web of finer cracks spanned outward from the center of the injury until they clouded the mirror with their sheer multitude. The Kyber quivered and seemed to sigh before it shattered. The mirror fell to pieces, 1,000,000 splinters, one caught in his knuckles. He would remove it only much later when he was far away from here. At that moment, he could only stare. As did she. He beheld the absence of divinity until he turned, before he could grasp what he had done, not to the mirror, but to her. Her eyes were still fixed on that which he had destroyed, the riven brilliance across the floor. The Ronin knew what came next. He left the temple, unspeaking. He half expected that his feet would be driven across the floor, but whatever spell had captured him within the man he had been had since dissolved, as had the memory of the world around them. Fractured and faded, until he was left alone with her and with himself, just them, in the midst of everything and nothing. The witch forced him to meet her unflinching gaze as she asked, "When did you know you would kill us?" He wanted to look away and couldn't. There was nothing else to see. Not then, he confessed. When? When I did it, I was not a thinking creature. I was breaking. Broken. I thought, somehow, that I was doing right by cutting out the sickness I'd seeded. Her hand was on her stomach, as if he had struck her there instead of the mirror. You killed us. Should I justify it? You can't. Then what? He felt suddenly, brutally old and wounded, short of breath. He tore the respirator away from his face. Would you have me dead? Her eyes on him were dark and unmoved.
What would that fix? He was breathless for a moment, then wheezed and pushed the respirator back to his face. He coughed once and again and wanted to speak but couldn't. It was miserable, humiliating. He received no further epiphanies. If he were clever, he would have known that for a blessing. He only needed to look as far as what had happened when he received his last. "Why did you ask me to come back?" he rasped at last. "I didn't." His brow creased. That wasn't true. She had invited him. She had sent the traveler with that shard, the very one he had dug from his hand when he was so far from her and what he'd done, that he had hidden away on Dekian. And now she had made some choice, was doing something with this resurgence of demons, something he didn't understand but dreaded. Yet when the pads of her fingers skimmed his cheek, resting on the edge where his prosthetic lined his jaw, and she turned him to look at her, he saw just truth in her mild frown. That was the mirror in its essence, as it had always been, even as it was now in pieces. Truth. "I never wanted you back," she said softly. "I couldn't stand the thought. But if you must..." He lost sight of her. Her absence was a hole inside him, consuming, and he was too keenly aware of his creaking bones. When he heard her again, it was a balm, even as her voice encircled, gripped, and shredded through what he was. For so long he hadn't wanted to be a living thing, that to be torn asunder was respite. So he thought, at least, until she laid her last curse. "If you must return, then you do it in my name," she said. And there was something new, something changed in this voice, something he had never heard before. "Honor mine as you never have yours." It was all nothing for a while after that. Then white, then black, then both, and neither, until she allowed him again to see. Chapter 34. The Ronin moved, unthinking, his body a vessel of desire sans intent. He had no sense of time, how much had passed, or how much now was passing. He only held his side with one hand, the mirror shard clutched to his chest in the other, as he staggered out of the galley. The traveler called out to him as they stood, but he had already left. He became aware that his destination was the cockpit as he stepped into it. Akia was already there, and though at first she looked like she wanted to chase him out, she remained at her tense seat before the controls. "Really hope you've got a solution, Grimm. We're on the verge of a situation." A glance at the consoles and out the window painted the problem. The Imperial fleet had done well for itself, clearing the field of all potential concerns. The poor crow was one of the last few questions remaining, and they had begun to close in on it. In the interest of efficacy, he held out his palm. The shard shone dully within it. "I know the way. To Reizu." Akia looked from his face to the shard, her expression initially contorted with a pity usually reserved for unintelligent children. Then it was the look of a woman who in theory liked what she had heard, but despised who she had heard it from. She raised her hands and nodded to permit him to take the co-pilot's seat. "Fine. Okay, not like we have time to argue. You tell me what you think you know, and we'll figure it out from there." They tried this once, twice. Him feeding her the calculations, her feeding them into the navicomputer. The navicomputer refused to hold any information he provided. Akia grew more troubled by the second, sending wary looks at the communications array and at the expanse of empty space outside the viewport. When the navicomputer blinked and growled and declared the third attempt an error as well, she cursed and threw up her hands. By then, the rest of the crew had gathered as well.
A pair of Jedi apprentices craned their necks over Chia's shoulders, trying to snatch their own glimpse of whatever strangeness was unfolding. Thus far, they'd seen nothing but an old man providing useless information to an increasingly agitated young woman. B-556 warbled protest. He was better equipped to speak with the Navic computer, was he not?
No.
The Ronin gripped the shard so hard it threatened to cut into his palm.
It won't work. You need me to do it. She gave me permission.
At this, the traveler's eyes widened and Koru's narrowed. Chia half turned to the apprentices as if she were readying to defend them. Akia seemed about to protest again when the communications array flared. Outside the viewport, the object of their dread lanced abruptly into view. The head of a great white spear soared inexorably forward, directly overhead, blocking the light of the Dekian sun. Another Jedi dreadnought. Akia's fist clenched over the poor crow's controls. One chance, she said over her shoulder. That's all we get, Grimm. If they didn't run soon, fast, correctly, they wouldn't get another chance to run at all. She let the Ronin have direct access to the Navi computer. This time, he didn't need to translate the mirror shard's murmuring intent into words. He only had to know. The coordinates flew from his fingers into the ship. Akia's brow furrowed ever deeper as she watched, doubting what she saw. The feed she received in her pilot seat still declared the Ronin's coordinates were in error, and she shook her head, as if trying to free it of a troublesome insect. Finally, the Navi computer didn't reject the numbers wholesale. Just in time. A contingent of small fighters detached from the dreadnought overhead as simultaneously the lights indicating the activation of its tractor beam illuminated on its undercarriage. Hold on, Akia warned, and they were away. Hyperspace unfolded blue and white and liquid around them until suddenly it didn't. It was too soon for them to have appeared back in the cold black reality of space, yet there they were. And there was no sign of the dreadnought that had loomed over them, or of Dekian, or indeed, of anything but for the new immensity that stretched before them. The poor crow floated under a gold-limbed blue sphere. A planet. Not Dekian. Reizu. It bore down on them with its obviousness, a looming impossibility.
Chapter 35.
The Ronin sagged in his seat. Beside him, Akia stared, breathless, at Reizu until the crow's consoles blazed to life all at once in a cacophony of erratic contradictions. The ship's systems couldn't agree with one another. One declared they were indeed looking up at Reizu, as simultaneously another insisted they weren't. Another warned that they were in orbit, while another vehemently disagreed that there was anything to orbit around. And where in all this was that light coming from? It shone from somewhere, bathing Reizu as surely as it did their fingers, the Ronin's glued to his ribs, Akia's to the navigation console, yet they couldn't see its source. A paradox. How fitting. They had been brought here by an impossible thing, and couldn't possibly hope to make sense of it. All the Ronin could say with certainty was that the voice, the witch, had allowed them to come. She had, hadn't she?
She extends an invitation, Handrai had said.
Yet in the dizzying depths of the mirror shard, she denied having done so. Had said she couldn't stand the thought of the Ronin's return, that she had never even imagined it. Nevertheless, she had let him through. Why? That question had to wait. They had too many more urgent problems to answer. Akia read them from the crow's outputs as the Ronin felt them in his bones and follicles. The vessel ached, its innards frayed by the strain of being thrown from the end of the galaxy that existed to the end that didn't. Akia gripped the controls. This might get bad, she warned the others. Whatever that jump did, the crow hated it. Oh, hell! The poor crow cried under their feet. Every eye was wide and untrusting.
They had just suffered a collapsing ship, and they couldn't help but suspect they might be about to suffer another. Akiya threw a suspicious look at the Ronin. He had earned it for the part he'd played in planting this fear. To her, he raised a cajoling hand. To the Traveler, he said,
"We may be in need of the skills you deployed on the Reverend."
"The Crow's a bit more complicated as a project," they warned.
"You have help," said Chie. She turned to the apprentices. "Master Edzuna needs you. Let them direct your focus."
Koru brought up the rear of that effort, following the rest out and throwing one last dubious look over her shoulder. As she left, Akiya turned to the Ronin.
"I've never... Where am I headed?"
"Never what?" He knew as soon as he thought it. "Never flown home." Had likely not ever even seen Reizu from its sky, until he'd ordered her taken to a distant front line alongside the other drafted children. The Ronin knew Reizu's skies because he had once flown down into them himself, a selfish maneuver for which he had been scolded, not least of all by B5. But he had always liked to be first to see a world, and to do it alone, in order to judge what dangers it might pose to his people before they were subjected to them. So he knew where to point her, and he brought up the coordinates on the nav.
"There."
Akiya had the ship moving as the red lights of imminent danger sparked on one after another. The Crow eased handily into the atmosphere, the hull jolted by new gravity. The Ronin's attention caught on the Crow's innards as they sputtered. It was as if the ship had sickened. Enfeebled as he was, he could do little to contribute to the effort to hold it together. Instead, he poured himself into monitoring the Crow's condition as its individual parts tried one by one to darken and drift. If he sensed any of them went untended, he alerted Chia via the internal comms, and she passed the warning on. For a nauseating moment, the poor Crow crested a mountain range and drifted, all silence. Then it dropped. They were weightless as they dropped with it. Time elongated. The Ronin was allowed to see the city that stretched out in the basin before them, hazy white with winter twilight, and marked by hundreds upon hundreds of delicate pointed roofs rising over all the others. The shrines and temples of old Yojo, the old capital, storied heart of the First Empire and home of a thousand gods. Beyond it lay the chasm and mountains where Shinsui Temple awaited. It was good to see it, and a curse. To be so close, only to fall. By luck or by prayer, the engine wailed back a light. Akiya's hands moved frantically across her consoles, taking that last breath of life to send the Crow lurching forward, away from the mountainside toward the expansive landing field the Ronin had directed her to. They lived. By that standard, the landing went well. Moreover, the Crow was still recognizably itself, even at the end of its blackened trail of broken-off parts. However, it was probably not safe to be on. They were all outside within minutes. The world that awaited them could not be easily reconciled. It was real enough to be uncomfortably cold, and unreal enough to require gaping. They had landed at the port adjacent to the Pilgrim's Ward, which boasted Yojo's densest collection of religious sites, and which had long been preserved by imperial edict. Its walls were all dark wood and white paint, its roofs tiled and long. To reach the ward, they would cross one of many bridges across the winter-sluggish Moga River that separated it from the rest of Yojo. It was how the pilgrims and tourists would have done it years ago, and why visitors had favored this port in particular. Many Sith had chosen to land there for similar reasons.